We thank you for the gift of this day. We thank you for the gift of Holden Village, for the staff and for the people who come here, and for your spirit who is among us. Be with us as we travel today. Be with us in all we do and say, that we might reflect your light and your love to the world. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Was anybody not here last time? I didn't know if I needed to do it. Want me to do it just a hair of review?
Okay.
I try to make these so that they're self-standing. You can miss a Bible study and still come in. But one thing that's hard about this particular Bible study is that I'm just picking little bits out of the longer narrative of the David story, which runs from 1 and 2 Samuel. I think I didn't say last time, one of the theories we have on why 1 and 2 Samuel is divided into two books. Does anybody know why we think it's divided into two books? Well, in ancient Israel, they would have written it down on these long scrolls. And it's such a long book that it was probably too long to fit on one scroll, and it ended up with two. So there we have it. In some older Hebrew Bibles and in some ancient manuscripts, it's still in just one. So it probably was just one book at one time. So the main figures in this book are Samuel, Hannah's son, who is really representing the older, traditional, conservative view of Israel. That Israel is God's own chosen people, that Israel is to reflect God's love, God's ways, and that God is the king. But Israel is clamoring for a monarchy, and so you have kind of two competing voices. Samuel represents the older order, the old guard, and then the people, many of the people saying we really need a king. And then Yahweh would be the third actor in this, that Yahweh doesn't really approve of a monarchy, but Yahweh permits it under certain conditions. And if you go back and read, I think it's in 1 Samuel chapter 8, there's this really lovely part of Samuel being very upset about what a monarchy could do to the people and how a monarch would serve the monarch's own purposes and not serve the people. And Yahweh's saying, well, if the monarch will listen to me, if the monarch will do what I want, then it could be okay. So Yahweh permits the monarchy, but with conditions. So Saul is the first king of Israel. He appears to have everything you would want in a king. It's a hilarious story to read how Saul is originally called and keeps hiding. But the Bible describes him as tall, good-looking, from this powerful tribe. And he just runs from his responsibility all throughout the narrative. He also doesn't trust God. And that's one of the key differences between he and David. So Samuel gets disappointed with Saul at a certain point and decides we are going to need a better monarch, because really one of the main reasons for having a king is that they need protection from these other nations that are going to come in and attack them, that are always threatening to them. And Saul won't lead them into battle, and he keeps losing militarily. But David can do that. David is a great warrior and leads his victory after victory after victory. And that's really one of the key things they need from a king. So, let's see. So those are really the three. It's David, Saul, and Samuel. But the women are in working throughout this. And we have more, in this story, we have more mention of women than almost any place else. So let me just, any questions so far before we get to David and his wives? Okay. So this is pretty important, this first bullet. That a woman's sexuality was generally under the control of a man in her family. So her father, if her father was gone, it might be a brother, and if she's married, it's her husband. And David's marriage has cast light on the role of women securing political power. We'll see that a little bit more with Abigail, that I think she's making a calculated move to some extent to secure her own, to get herself security by marrying David. So we have eight wives for David. It mentions other concubines, but these are the ones we have by name. The first one is Michal, and she's Saul's daughter. And I don't really know how to pronounce all of these. This one right here, that is another daughter of the king. So all of that is giving David more power as he's making alliances through these marriages. And then finally, Bathsheba is the last one we have mentioned. So Michal, she's the second daughter of King Saul. And King Saul is jealous of David for many reasons. The Bible tells us that David is a very good-looking guy. Kind of the way it's described, it's like David's hot. He's really and the people love him. It says that all over the Bible, that the people love him. He is successful militarily. He seems to have Yahweh's favor. And so Saul is desperately trying to kill David. There's almost a humorous aspect if you go through reading about all the ridiculous things Saul does to try to kill David. And he continues to put him in battles where he's sure to kill him, and doesn't. David comes out on top. Michal is the only woman in Hebrew scriptures that it says she actually loved a man. And that verb can sometimes mean that they loved them for political power, but it seems to indicate in this text that she actually emotionally loves him. It's the only woman that we have that. And David wants her. It doesn't say that David loves her back, so we don't know. But she is, you know, in terms of securing his power, she's the daughter of King Saul. So it is going to make his claim to the throne much more secure. And we'll look at that last thing in a minute. So now, let's read a little bit. We're going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 18. David and Saul, and how David is so popular and Saul is not. So I'm starting in 18, verse 6. As they were coming home, when David returned from killing the Philistine, the women came out of all the towns of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they made merry, "Saul has killed his thousands, and David his 10,000." Saul was very angry, for this saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom?" So Saul eyed David from that day on. The next day, an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day, and Saul had his spear in his hand. And Saul threw the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." But David eluded him twice. So it's Saul's kind of crazy. Can you imagine? He's played his, oh, there goes Saul again. He's like, whoops. Twice he tries to kill him. So Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000. And David marched out and came in, leading the army. David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for it was he who marched out and came in leading them. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my elder daughter, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines deal with him." So he's intentionally trying to have him killed again in battle. David said to Saul, "Who am I? Who are my kinsfolk, my father's family in Israel, that I should be the son-in-law to the king?" So David's showing real deference there. But at the time when Saul's daughter Merab should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel as a wife. So offers the daughter, takes her away. So now Saul's daughter Michal loved David. Saul was told, and the thing pleased him, and Saul thought, "Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." So he's going to require that David do something in battle in order to win his daughter's hand. So this is another way for him to kill David. Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, "You shall now be my son-in-law." Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David in private and say, 'See, the king is delighted with you,
and all his servants love you. Now and then become the king's son-in-law. I don't know what the now and then means. Oh, now then become the king's son-in-law. So Saul's servant reported these words to David in private. And David said, does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, seeing that I am a poor man and of no repute? So this allows Saul to drive a harder bargain, because David's admitting that he really doesn't deserve to be married to the king's daughter. Then the servants of Saul told him, this is what David said. And then Saul said, thus shall you say to David, the king desires no marriage present except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged on the king's enemies. Yeah, that's quite a thing. You know, and there's several things there. Partly, you know that they're not Israelites. And it's they really pretty much have to be dead if you're going to get those. So he's saying, you got to go kill 100 of these if you're going to have my daughter. And the Philistines were these renowned mighty warriors. These are the people that the Israelites are most afraid of. They're the fiercest. So maybe one, maybe two, but 100, this is really quite the feat. And in the next verse, there's our translations don't say anything here that indicate that it's more than 100, but older manuscripts, the Masoretic text, indicates that David actually doubles the number. Mm-hmm. So David rose and went along with his men and killed 100 of the Philistines, and David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. Saul gave him his daughter Michal as a wife. But when Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that Saul's daughter Michal loved him, Saul, and as some people say Michael, I'm not exactly sure how you would, seems like it's not quite that, but Saul was still more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy from that time forward. So we'll kind of stop there. Any questions or thoughts?
I had a friend named Michael.
Is she spelled learning like that? Yeah.
Michael.
Yeah. I'm just not sure what the Hebrew pronunciation.
And we don't really, because they don't have vowels, they have dots and everything. We're not exactly sure how they pronounce them.
Yeah.
So. Well, they have a little triangle going now. You know?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's like, well, Saul is out, actually, because Michael really does love David. But and that's the way it should be, but he didn't think it would go that way. He thought she would be a snare for him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Does Saul have sons?
He has sons, and in fact, in this very next chapter, his son Jonathan is the same verb that's used with Michael, that he actually loves David, and he's going to go to great lengths to protect and be friends to David. So Saul's own children are turning against Saul.
Right.
Well, he's nuts.
He is. It's really a fun story. It's kind of a sad. It almost sometimes reads like a Shakespearean tragedy.
It happens exactly what Samuel thought may happen.
Yeah.
King happens with Saul.
And it also happens with David in the Bathsheba story.
Of course it does.
Yeah.
But at this point, it happens so blatantly mm-hmm. with Saul. And yes, it happens with David, and it happens
with Solomon.
Everybody
yeah.
who is.
Well, Saul has several sons that are named, and David takes care of one of them. I mean, it's a great
Jonathan.
Story. Well, Jonathan, but then there's another one
that he takes care of.
Yeah.
Grandson.
That's right. Yeah. I can't exactly remember the name.
Yeah, but there's often kind of a homophobic attitude toward maybe Jonathan.
Well, I wasn't going to bring that up, but since you did, it's interesting that there is a scholarly debate between David and Jonathan with interpreters of whether or not that is a homosexual love story because of the verbs and the way it's portrayed. I have heard scholars I really respect say absolutely. The way the narrative plays out, the way the Hebrew plays out, this is absolutely. Others who I totally respect say no, it's not. And both sides of those arguments, they're on either side of the... I mean, the people that say it's not are not necessarily theologically opposed to homosexuality. They just don't think the text supports it. I don't know nearly enough about it to speak to it. It is interesting to read it and to know that that debate goes on with this particular story.
But it sounds like everybody is hot after David.
Yeah.
Except Paul. Yeah.
Yeah.
Saul's some hot after Saul.
Yeah.
So then, let's see, where's the next place I want to have us read? Now, let's go to the next chapter, 19, verse 11. And the first part of that talks about Jonathan kind of trying to protect David from his dad. So then verse 11, Saul sent messengers to David's house to keep watch over him, planning to kill him in the morning. And David's wife, Michal, told him, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let David down through the window. He fled away and escaped. So the house was probably built into a city wall, and then he's coming down that way. Michal took an idol and laid it on the bed. She put a net of goat's hair on its head and covered it with the clothes. So evidently this idol is pretty much human size. I mean, it's not a little thing. It's got to be about 5 or 6 feet long. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick." Then Saul sent the messenger to see David for themselves. He said, "Bring him up to me in the bed that I might kill him." So just transport him like the medic thing, you know. Just put him on a stretcher, bring him up, I'll take care of him that way. When the messengers came in, the idol was in the bed with the covering of goat's hair on its head. And Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" And then now David fled and escaped, blah, blah, blah. So it's her action that saves David's life here. It's because of her that David is, and that got that on the last thing. And there's more than once that a woman is going to save David's life.
Mm-hmm. Could you read what you have, because I have a different translation. Could you read what she responds to Saul again?
In verse
12b.
12b.
The last half of 12, I guess.
You mean Michael
answered
Saul?
Sorry, 17.
It's those
17. Okay. 17.
Saul.
Why have you, and she said, and
what does she say to
her? He said to me, "Let me go. Why should I kill you?"
What's your question? Okay. So she, so David is saying to her, "Why should I kill you?"
No. That's the conversations between her and Saul. Why have you deceived me like this? She's lying to her dad.
Right. And she said, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'"
Yeah, she lies to him.
That David
Michal lies to protect herself.
Yeah, because mine says, "I had to. He threatened to kill me if I didn't help him."
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that's why I wanted to know the word.
Well, and when you have this in your English translation, when you have two things, that means the translators aren't agreeing on how to translate that. And we probably have different manuscripts that are saying different things.
Which version is that one?
This is New Living Translation. It's a newer one.
So is it a translation or is it a paraphrase?
No, it's a translation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I need to know exactly where you are.
Oh, 17.
chapter
19,
verse
17.
17.
Okay. So it's Michael's response to her father.
But it actually is, I think Michal is saying, she's saying, "Let me go. Why should I kill you?" And yours says, "He said to me, I will kill you."
Yeah, she said, "I had to. He threatened to kill me if I didn't help him." So she's still lying to him, but
yeah,
the word is
and this
different.
Does imply that,
yeah.
That, you know,
yeah.
But it's a little gentler.
Yeah.
This is softer than yours.
Yeah.
David said, "Okay." Yeah. He kind of implies this version.
Said, "Let me go.
Kind of implies this
okay.
version where, Michal answered Saul, and he said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" In other words, she couldn't hold on to it.
Right, yeah.
But she's making up that answer that that's what he means to do.
Right.
Yeah.
But she's not saying, "I helped him escape because I loved him." No. She's like, "Oh, I was the victim here."
Right.
Yeah. Because I think she's fearing for her life. Her dad is not opposed to kill her.
The Bible always makes everybody feel so much better about their own families.
We were at a football, that super football, and they had the commercial about Amazing Grace. And I just couldn't I love that story, just like visiting family.
You had a question back there?
Just real quick, I think it's interesting that, you know, we know what Michal said about, we know her lie about what she did. We don't know the truth about what she did. Like, how did she know that the next day was going to be such an important thing? I've always read it in, this is not in the text, but that, like, probably it was her servants.
That would be my guess.
Who were probably also women. So we see one more way that,
yeah.
that women are exerting influence and control and and doing it in this text, God's word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right. They would be
the
servants talk.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to skip over a couple of my next slides because I'm going to come back and talk about the ark, but I'm going to wait. We're going to talk about Abigail next in chapter 25. This is a great chapter. This whole story stands alone. And if we have time, I really do want to look at the Bathsheba story for a minute, because if you hold those two together, I think that the Bathsheba story is really informed by Abigail's story and how David has changed and how David's ability to listen to anybody who influenced has changed. So Abigail plays a huge role in David's life here. Does anybody else want to read?
Starting in chapter 25.
Chapter 25 what?
We're going to read that entire chapter, so verse 1.
Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him. They buried him at his home at Ramah. Then David got up and went down to the wilderness of Parah. There was a man of Moab whose property was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel.
I'm going to stop you just there for a minute. So this would be a big celebration. It would be kind of like a festival. They're shearing sheep. And you partly measure your wealth by how much livestock you have. So his wealth is very visible right now. Everybody can see just how wealthy he is because he's got all these sheep and goats there.
Well, okay. How much older was Samuel than David?
I guess I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't really look at the story that much. He's older, but how much? And, you know, again with the manuscript, it's hard to even judge David's. If we looked at the David and Goliath story, how old is David there? We always think of him as a young boy, but there's a lot of indication that he's quite a bit older. He's maybe a young adult.
Samuel had anointed David before Goliath, but he also grew up as a priest from whatever age we want to decide, when his mother stopped meeting him.
Yeah.
You know, and so he could have been a younger priest, but I always think of him as established.
Yeah,
as the primary priest of Israel.
Mm-hmm. I love how well you guys know this story. I mean, you've actually read your Bibles. This is really cool. Okay, go ahead. Keep reading, starting with 3.
Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was clever and beautiful, but the man was surly and mean. He was a Calebite.
His name actually translates as fool. And hers translates as, she's just the complete opposite of her husband. She's wise, she's discerning, she's beautiful. She's actually, in a lot of ways, the same verbs used of her are used of David. That same beautiful verb is, I think, the one that's used of David. So she's a very beautiful woman, but very bright. And her husband is a very wealthy idiot. So, yeah, keep going.
David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, go to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. Thus you shall salute him. Peace be to you and peace to your house. And peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shepherds. Now your shepherds have been with us. And we did them no harm. And they missed nothing all the time they were here.
Okay, so just a couple things. That one tribe that they said he was with, that's a leading clan in Judah. And David is actually intimidating here. I mean, he comes in saying peace, 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 but he's really actually subtly, or maybe not so subtly, intimidating and saying, you know, kind of extorting him a little bit for money. So, keep going.
Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your sight, for we have come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. But Nabal answered David's servants, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are breaking away from their masters.
Yeah, and back in chapter 22, it's going to tell us that David's people that are with him, they're kind of a ragtag group. They're
Robin Hood's men.
Yeah, and so, you know, and he's looking at him. Plus, it's this, he's the eighth son of the tribe of Jesse, which is kind of this little tribe. You know, who is this guy? I'm not paying any attention. But he also obviously hasn't been paying any attention. I mean, it's the because everybody knows what a great military leader David is and how loyal and beloved David is. And so
but he has forgotten his place as far as this
goes. Right, right. But, you know, this guy, this is where his name is working. He's a fool to have forgotten who he's actually talking to. So, yeah.
I do think it's interesting, though, where it was saying that your son David, so Nabal is older than him, and it's like, even though he's working his way in, but he's respecting him that he's an elder, but he's still trying to work his way in to get something from him.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, keep reading. Finish up to verse 13, I think.
Shall I take my bread and my water and the meat that I have butchered for my shearers and give it to the men who come from I do not know where? So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. David said to his men, every man strap on his sword. And every one of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword, and about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage.
Yeah, so you can see we're about to have a battle here, and this is where Abigail is going to come in to this battle. Anybody want to read after? Pick it up. Okay.
But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute our master, and he shouted insults at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we never missed anything when we were with them in the fields, as long as we were with them. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, while we were there keeping with the sheep. Now, therefore, know this, and consider that you should do. For evil has been decided against our master and against all his house. He was so ill-natured that no one can speak to him.
Which is pretty telling. You know, he doesn't listen to anybody, and his servants are even going to work against him now, and they probably are convinced they're going to die if they don't. Yeah, keep going.
Then Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep ready-dressed, 5 measures of parched grain, 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs. She loaded them on donkeys and said to her young men, go on ahead of me, I'm coming after you. She did not tell her husband Nabal.
And actually what she is taking is a pretty elaborate, extravagant gift. They're listing all of this to say that she's going to try to buy them off.
Right.
Yeah.
As she rode on the donkey and came down under cover of the mountain, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, surely it was in vain that I protected all this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed and all belonged to him. But he has returned me evil for good. God, do so to David and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him.
Okay, so this is one of my favorite parts in this chapter, because I got, on verse 22, I was spent about half an hour on that word male. That there is a Hebrew word for male that means just kind of how we would interpret it, and that's not what's used here. And I couldn't find an English translation that uses what the Hebrew direct translations use. And the way it actually translates, it's like it's a slur. So they're actually, it's a slur that kind of talks, it's kind of crude, but it's basically somebody who pees against a wall. So they're there, and it's actually cruder than that. So they're being defined. They're being defined by their method of urination. So about as low as you can go. It's fascinating to me why translators go one way or the other, or why they clean it up and sanitize it for us. But anyway, I just kind of was like, is this really right? Is it right? Is it right? And then I started checking things. It's like, yeah, that's really how it reads. But see if you can find an English translation that says
it. Wall peer.
Yeah.
Yeah,
King
James
says
kissers.
No.
Oh, it did. You found it in King James. I didn't check King James.
Yeah. What does it say? King James says, sow and mourn also do God unto the enemies of David. If I leave all that pertain to him by the morning light, any that pisseth against the wall.
And that was the word that I wasn't going to use. because I didn't want to be too crude, and, but that is actually how it translates.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that the King James has that right? Fascinating. Okay, so that's actually a little diversion. It doesn't have that much to do with Abigail, but I just...
Sidebar,
yeah. So, when Abigail saw David, she hurried and alighted from the donkey and fell before David on her face, bowing to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "Upon me alone, my lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. My lord, do not take seriously this ill-natured fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he." Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent. Basically, I think she's saying she didn't talk to them, and had she talked to them, she wouldn't have let this happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of suggests
she
runs interference
for
a moment. Yeah, so she's going to do it once again. And I get this feeling from her that she's one of these people that can see everything. And she can see, boy, if things go down this way, my husband's going to die and everybody's going to be slaughtered, and then where am I going to be? And if David does this head on, he may die, and then where am I going to be? And so she is kind of working to protect her own interests and also to avert this, it's going to be this, if she doesn't get in there.
And she might have had a son.
Right, we don't know. Yeah.
So why did his parents name him that?
I don't know.
Well,
they tell them to get it. And to an extent, is it story too? You know, did they really name him that, or is this really a story told to tell a deeper truth?
Or did people start calling him that because he was
right?
I took a Bible study with Arab Christian, and so since they read their Bible in Arabic and they have a different type of a translation. One of the things that was very interesting is so many things have different meanings. I mean, like even the name of a town or anything actually will say this is where everybody brings their sheep or this is where the threshing area is. So, you know, like Carmel might have a different meaning that we just think of, oh, that nice city along the ocean.
And I think it does have a different, I didn't look at it that closely, but I think pay attention to all those details because they are often symbolizing something else. And something that would probably have been much more obvious to the original hearers of this story, and that's partly why we study it. It's like they might have caught all the things that we're missing unless we get in there and study. So.
I would also think that David said his men because the troops would have been fed by people in the area, and here was a wealthy person. And she may have been the one, as the probably head wife, who was over the stores. You know, and although you would still go to the mall to ask, she had probably gotten.
She's been running things for
she's
a long
time.
She's been running things. And if she realized what was happening,
she would have averted it from going to him. You know, and it was just a normal thing to go and ask, especially the wealthy, because the poor in the area really couldn't afford to help. And he had, 800 troops?
Right, we're told he's very wealthy.
And then David had a huge army.
Yeah, he did. So does anybody want to read starting in verse 26? Okay, I'll keep going. "Now then, my lord, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, since the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from taking vengeance with your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my lord be like Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my lord be given to the young men who follow my lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my lord a sure house. Because my lord is fighting the battles of the Lord," notice that one is capitalized and one is not, "and evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. If anyone should rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living." This is like a metaphor that shows long life, eternal life, and it is an expression that you find on a Jewish tombstone, I think. "Bundle of the living under the care of the Lord your God, but the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling." This almost reads like a benediction here for a king. When the Lord has done to my Lord according to you, to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause or having saved himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. So partly what this scene shows is that David has this potential for violence to kind of this knee-jerk reaction, and that she's saving him from that. So there's just so much here. Other thoughts? Then this is David's response. David is really, he's going to bless her, and he's going to start with Yahweh. So David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you to me today." So he kind of realizes what she has done and is blessing her for that. "Blessed be your good sense, and blessed be you who have kept me today from blood guilt and from avenging myself by my own hand. For as surely as the Lord of God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there would not have been left to Nabal so much as one male." Then David received from her hand what she had brought him. He said to her, "Go up to your house in peace. See, I have heeded your voice, and I have granted your petition." And Abigail came to Nabal. He was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. You know, he is really defined by his possessions from the beginning of the story to the end. That's all he's serving. That's all he's concerned about. That's really all we know about is how he treats his things. And that's his total definition. Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. And in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him. He became like a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. Which is convenient. So she's not very tired. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has judged the case of Nabal's insult to me and has struck back his servant from evil. The Lord has returned the evil doings of Nabal upon his own head." Then David sent the wooed Abigail to make her his wife. When David's servants came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife." She rose and bowed her head with her face to the ground and said, "Your servant is a slave to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." Abigail got up hurriedly and rode away on a donkey. Her five maids attended her. She went after the messengers of David and became his wife. And then we hear about Michal again. So David also married, they list another one, Adonam of Jezreel, both of them became his wives. Saul had given his daughter Michal, David's wife, to Palti, son of Lash, who was from Galilee. Saul has no right to do this. He's taken her out and he's given her to somebody else. We don't know how she feels about it, but she's now somebody else's wife. It's a political game for her.
She doesn't have any choice.
She doesn't have any choice. He also didn't have any right to do that. That's, and it weakens David's.
That's a real insult.
Yeah, and it weakens David's claim to the throne because he's not alive with her and they don't have any children. And the Bible is clear to point that out a little bit later. So I think later on that we end up, the last we hear about her, it doesn't paint her in a very good light. I have this kind of tender spot for her because she's just getting used all over the place and she's trying to do the best she can.
She's a pawn.
She is.
She's a pawn. And when she comes back, I always wondered if because she was of Saul's lineage that she had no children.
That, I think that's very clear.
And I think it's very clear in there that it's because all of Saul's lineage, but then there's a grandson.
Yeah, but is that from somebody else?
Well, yeah, but I mean, if all of Saul's lineages, you would think a male.
They don't necessarily count all, when they say
sons.
A lineage,
it's
sons.
Not, it
it's
was sons. It was
so
sons.
This could be a daughter's son.
No,
but
it wasn't
a grandson.
No, it
was,
I don't know,
it was
one of the sons. And
it's been a while since I've looked at that particular part. Other thoughts on the Abigail?
Yeah, I just, just taking a little bit of idea about her being a pawn. I think she's, you know, these men want her.
Right.
This is a very powerful woman. This woman knows what to do and in what situation.
Yeah.
Okay, she can prevent wars.
Oh, Abigail.
And Abigail.
Yeah.
And David wants her.
Right.
I was thinking that, you know, in later days,
day, Lady Bird Johnson, you know, and her husband, Lady Bird's the one that brought that smooth feathers in the White House. Lyndon loved her.
Yeah.
Lyndon loved her and knew what he had, but that woman soothed feathers, if you read that history, a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, this is a woman who soothed feathers.
Mm.
And these men knew her as a powerful woman. So, you know, you don't have much choice of, well, you get offers for marriage there or somebody passes you off. But this woman is not as much of a pawn as a piece of power.
Yeah, I think that's very true with her.
Yeah.
I think she's very powerful.
Yeah, so, and I think that's kind of interesting,
yeah.
But I think we forget how powerful some women can be.
Right.
You know, because what they say, the two most powerful words in the White House during the Johnson administration were, now Lyndon.
and
but there was love there.
Right.
There was also respect.
And I think the Bible is clear to point out that as a woman, she has the brains, she has the foresight, she has the diplomatic sense. I mean, she's the one.
She's on her equal standing in favor.
Yeah.
What?
She's on equal standing.
She is. Yeah.
She is.
They're pointing her that way.
We wanted her.
Right.
That's a good one.
One other point. If she would have been a widow in the society, she, and particularly if she didn't have any grown children, she would have been in a very bad place.
Right. And that's partly, I think, why she doesn't remember me. Whatever happens here, remember me, you know, and what I've done for you here. Make sure that if I become a widow, then I'm taken care of.
Yeah.
So, well, I want to kind of push ahead a little bit, so I'm going to just go to 2 Samuel, chapter 3. There's just a few verses there where we look at Michal or McCall again. And I find it. Here it is. 3:12, where we know a little bit more about her and what has happened to her. And battles going on. Abner sent messengers to David at Hebron, saying, "To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and I will give you my support and bring all Israel over to you." He said, "Good. I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you. You shall never appear in my presence unless you bring Saul's daughter, Michal, when you come to see me." Then David sent messengers to Saul's son, Ishbal, saying, "Give me my wife, Michal, to whom I became engaged at the price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines." Ishbal sent and took her from her husband, Paltiel, son of Lash, but her husband went with her weeping as he walked behind her all the way to Bahurim. And then Abner said to him, "Go back home." So he went back.
It's kind of like a sore spot for David to
have
her.
Yeah, and we don't know that he loves her. I mean, and it appears that the person she's married to now does love her. And I mean, it's just this really sad thing to me that's what's happened to her. So come back up a little bit. I want to talk about the Ark because that becomes important to the last little thing with McCall. So the Ark of the Covenant, it was a portable.
Yeah.
Device. We don't know how big. I mean, we have dimensions and things that are listed in the Bible, but there's a lot of guesswork involved. It's where you contain the Ten Commandments, and it symbolized the covenant between Yahweh and the Hebrews. They would carry it with them wherever they went in the desert. It was resting at Shiloh. We know at the beginning of the story, that's where people went to worship. It symbolized God's presence among them. The holiness of God is present in the Ark. If you touched it, it would be to impinge on God's holiness and to presume too much. And it's again, in this story, it's talked about a lot in battle. The Philistines captured at one time, and there's this interesting stuff that happens. It shows the raw presence of God. It can be a blessing, but you have to handle it properly. And so David moves the Ark to Jerusalem. And remember, there's this old guard that doesn't want a monarchy at all. And by doing that, he is putting the Ark in his new city, which he has recently won. It's where his power and his theology is doing. He's solidifying his power by moving it there. So now the old guard, if they want to worship, they got to come to Jerusalem, to David's city. It's going to be a really unifying thing, actually. But he's very calculated. So, and now Yahweh is residing. That's symbolically what it shows. Do I have a picture? Yeah, that's kind of a good guess. Everything means something on there. I won't talk about it too much because I want to keep moving. It's just to kind of give you a... an idea of what we're talking about here. So if you go to chapter 6, this is our last look at what happens with McCall, and I have really mixed feelings about it. So starting with verse 17 in chapter 6, they brought in the ark of the Lord. There it is. They brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and offerings of well-being before the Lord. When David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the offerings of well-being, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts and distributed food among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, to each a cake of bread, a portion of meat, and a cake of raisins. Then all the people went back to their homes. Now this is almost like a private conversation that you'd have in your home between David and his wife. David returned to bless his household, but Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel has honored himself today, uncovering himself before the eyes of his servants' maids, as any vulgar fellow might shamelessly uncover himself." It's almost like the slave girls. She's just saying he's being vulgar, basically. This isn't how a king acts. I know how a king acts. I'm a king's daughter. This isn't how a king acts. David said to Michal, "If it was before the Lord chose me in place of your father and all his household to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord that I have danced before the Lord, I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in my own eyes. But by the maids of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor." And then it just ends, "And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death."
So maybe he dismissed her?
He did, and he uses his own words to dismiss her. And my note says, probably because David had no relations with her, her children would have been Saul's heirs and a threat to his throne. So that might have been a calculated thing.
I kind of wonder if she had children with her other husband.
Yeah.
Because that would have, yeah.
It would have. So did she get to go back to him?
I don't think so.
I know. It's just,
she became more like property.
Oh, she totally
said,
like property.
You know, like, I got her back. I did all this to get her. She was taken away from me. It was a sore spot. Now I get her back because I have more power, and now she's just property to me. I'm just collecting wives now.
Yeah, and he is actually doing that, collecting wives. So,
what rank did they? Because usually the first wife was head wife.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, so she might have still had a decent rank.
Because she is the first wife, right?
Yeah, she is the first wife.
But you kind of wonder if she's the third wife then, too, after Abigail.
She triangulated back with her father.
Yeah.
And she didn't respect the
I think that's what the that's what the story is saying. Yeah.
She didn't have any choice.
Women
were property.
I know. It's a hard thing.
And he was the king.
I think what the narrative is saying is what you're saying, that she's not.
She's the third wife because she lost her place.
What would you say? What you said? She went back. She kind of turned against David.
Yeah, she triangulated back with her father. She didn't have respect for the God of Israel that her husband loved and played the lyre to whenever he had the opportunity to praise God. And
I think that's the underlying theme. It's faithfulness to Yahweh, and that's how you're blessed. And there's also a small, you know, one of the themes that plays throughout this story is reversal of fortunes. So hers is being reversed here, and David's is being once more held up. So we've got 10 minutes left to do David and Bathsheba, if you want to move on to chapter 11.
But it also, to me, I was just going to say, it also, we'll just talk about the servant girls, and he's displaying himself in front. It was like,
become
groupies. You know, he's a rock star.
Yeah, and she just really doesn't think this is how he should be acting.
Right, yeah.
And to me, his response is, "The people have put me here. God and the people have put me here. I am of the people."
And he's shifting, too. He's, he's always duplicitous. I don't always like him. And I think the Bible is showing that there is room. He's serving his own interests all the time. There are some, he generally repents. He doesn't say, it says he loves the Lord, but he's pretty self-serving. And
I just identify with him. I think he seems so human.
Right.
That he's so much like all of us, that we have moments when we're very self-serving, looking out for ourselves. And we have moments when we're really in communion with God and, you know, but I see him as just, I guess that's why I've always liked him and liked his Psalms, is because it's something I can relate to. Because he isn't always really perfect.
No.
And then he was, I mean, that Christ came from somebody that was not perfect. It's a comfort.
Yeah. Okay, let me look real fast at this, my notes here. Okay. So I'm just going to start at the beginning of chapter 11. The first verse tells us so much. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab with his officers and all Israel with him. They ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. David was successful because of his military battles and because of his faithfulness to Yahweh, but it's the military battles that really made him the king that he was. And now he's not going out and fighting them anymore.
He's sending
other people. The verbs are really telling here. He's sending other people, and he's staying back at home, safe and sound, and other people are in the middle of the battle. It happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof of a woman bathing, the woman who was very beautiful. So other people are out fighting for him. Late in the day, he's not doing much. We kind of get the impression that he's grown pretty comfortable and lazy. And she's bathing. And that would have been a ritual purification. Almost certainly, it was right after she'd had her period. So he would have known by that bath that she was pretty fertile. All of that's really telling. He knows exactly what he's doing. And
he's become a voyeur.
And it does. And people do say, so why was she there? Why didn't she go somewhere else? And she was very beautiful. I don't know that the story's that concerned about that. It's really focused in on David. I think a mistake people make is when they try to place Bathsheba as an equal to David. The story isn't concerned. It's really about who he has become. He has become what Samuel warned them about, the person that will use people for their own gain. David sent someone to inquire about the woman. It was reported, this is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. So he's a foreigner. So David sent messengers to get her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself after her period. Then she returned to her house. The woman conceived. She sent and told David, I am pregnant. So David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab and the people fared and how the war was going. And then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the entrance of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. When they told David Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, you have just come from a journey. Why did you not go down to your house? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah remain in booths. And my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do such a thing. He's saying everything's at risk. We've got the ark out there. We've got half of Israel out there. You know, everything's at risk here. I'm not going to go out and do this. And it's interesting that Uriah the Hittite, the foreigner, seems to know not only the right thing to do, he seems to know the Torah or the law better than David himself. And he's the one that's keeping it. It's also interesting to look at it and wonder how much Uriah might suspect. Did people mention it to him? Does he know? Is he making a point? I think you can argue for that. I don't think we know for sure, but I think you can think about that. So then David said to Uriah, remain here today, also and tomorrow I will send you back. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day. On the next day, David invited him to eat and drink in his presence and made him drunk. It doesn't say that David's drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his Lord, but he did not go down to his house. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter, he wrote, send Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw him back from him so that he may be struck down and die. So I'll just kind of quit there. I mean, I think what the point I wanted to make about Bathsheba, when you read this, is that that what I said earlier, it's a mistake to give her equal footing with David, and it's a mistake to say that she's equally, I mean, could she have done what Abigail did? Maybe, but I don't think that the story is concerned with that. I think they're showing that David has become something, he's been become corrupted by his own power. He's not listening to anybody else, he's not taking anybody's counsel. He knows exactly what he's doing, he knows exactly who she is, he knows that she's fertile, he knows that her husband, that she's married, he knows her husband's out for battle. Doesn't matter, it's what he wants, and he's gonna take it.
What do you think about her sending word to him that she's pregnant? I mean, is that typical? I mean, he brings her over, he seduces her, rapes her, whatever, and then she sends a note saying, I'm pregnant?
Yeah.
Does she just know that her husband
She would know right away.
She would know, and well, she, wouldn't everybody know that it couldn't be Urias? And she's in this situation of, well, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Everyone will know that this can't be my husband.
And
she could have been killed for that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she could have absolutely been killed for that. And probably, you know,
so
I think most
like,
likely would have been killed.
What are you going to do about it?
So,
I mean, for a common person to write a note to a king.
Right,
I
think it's
so
it's a really good point. What did she risk by even writing that note?
Yeah. But I guess if death was her other choice, then
she's in trouble no matter what she does. You know, I mean, if she refused the king, I've heard people say she should have argued with him, she should have told him no, she should have. And again, so you can have those discussions, and it's, but you just have to keep in your mind that. The text isn't concerned with that. The text is concerned with David. So other thoughts? I mean, we're kind of pushing it right up against the hour.
She becomes the mother of Solomon later, and that was a really big thing.
Yeah.
She lost.
But she has this terrible, I'm gonna do my coffee thing here again. So go ahead and talk.
Well, David often agreed that they wouldn't lose that one baby, but they did. And but there was a comfort of God's grace that then Solomon was born, and Solomon became the king and was quite the king. And so that was an honor for Bathsheba, even though she went through all these struggles. And so I think that's the word of grace for all of us, that, you know, in our families, even when difficult, awful things happen, still God's grace is able to reverse.
Debbie's looking at me. Do you need water?
Thank you, dear.
And that's hope. You know, that's
hope,
right. And grace.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Thanks.
But I also would say David is aging, you know, he's not hot anymore. He's kind of spent himself, but he has memories.
He wasn't the king with Abigail, and he was the king with them.
Yeah.
Excuse me, you don't have a choice.
I think that's very true.
One, you're female, and the king sent servants. You're coming.
Has anybody heard a sermon where the pastor goes on and on about Bathsheba and her responsibility?
Really?
That's me. Oh, yeah.
How could she even argue with the king? I mean,
I know. Well, see, I think it's kind of the viewpoint. This is one thing why it's good to have women in the discussion and in seminary.
Yeah.
Because I think we react kind of like we are here. And it's like, and I think men will go, well, you know, she's a good looking woman. What's he supposed to do?
Yeah.
Guy's a guy.
Not all men will.
I know. You have to have lots of voices in the conversation, lots of perspectives, so that
we
can kind of.
For me, I think it reminds us of how much we bring to our reading of
mm-hmm.
the text. We want it to be convenient for us, and this library refuses to be convenient,
mm-hmm.
and that's why it's worth studying, and that's why it persists.
Right. I just ignore the parts I don't like.
That's a very useful response. I mean, the point on that is this is the point of doing it in community, because probably the person you don't like, someone else may have found really enlightening somehow. And thank God for that.
Right. Yeah. And it doesn't let you off the hook. You just have to keep wrestling with it.
And yeah. God doesn't let David off the hook. He sends a prophet to him who tells a little story about the only sheep raised in the house who gets eaten. You know, and then he says to David,
I would, yeah.
You
what would
are
you do?
That guy. Yeah. You took that man's only wife. You had all these wives. Mm-hmm. And then David repents.
And that is kind of where God can come back in, when David recognizes his sin and repents, which isn't really what Saul ever does. And I think that's the message we take out of it. When you screw up, there is grace and forgiveness, but real people get hurt by this. And real people die.